Welcome to the Partners for Progressive Israel podcast. My name is Nicole Cooper, and I'm your host today. This episode is about Gaza, and we will hear from someone who lives in Gaza and someone who is Israeli and lives on the border of Gaza and works with Gazans and has a dear, dear friend who lives there. This summer, my volunteer group and I spent a full day driving the border of Gaza and Israel and down to Egypt. Of course, Gaza is so small it doesn't take a full day, but we stopped to go over history, to talk with people, and gaze out onto the city from distant hills. In our email for that day, the program said, Gaza border tour. And after 4 months of really intense trips around Israel and West Bank Palestine, I didn't prepare for what that meant. We all nonchalantly got into the car and started a regular feeling road trip. My memory now jumps to arriving at Kibbutz Mordechai, where Roni lives, who you'll hear from shortly. The kibbutz is at the separation wall, in the green buffer zone. Two soldiers were in a pillbox staring at us passively as we stretched our sore legs from the drive. It took us a while to realize they were there, despite knowing it is rare to be unwatched anywhere in this region of the world. We will hear Roni talk about her experience and the kibbutz. I won't explain that, but I will step forward to my first stopping point on the trip. At the northern tip of Gaza, standing on Israeli soil and under a memorial to an Israeli soldier, my eyes rested upon built-up concrete and tried to understand if what I was seeing was flattened concrete in another area. It was hard to tell from our so close but so far viewpoint what was what. It was right there, this thing, a thing that I have only seen in images and the news, a city. A regular-looking city, a city where people live and dance and make music and have children. A city with no access to water, to electricity, and to leaving, and so much violence. In this moment, it was silent, looking like any other Palestinian city I visited. The reification of the mysterious. The call to prayer sounded. And I thought about how much Gaza is left out of discussions around the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in general talks and activist circles. It seems like people have no idea what to do with it, so we just don't even bring it up. The most recent war, last summer in 2014, is fresh in people's minds and people's traumas. We're going to hear from Roni about her story, and then we're also going to hear from my friend Ahmed, who lives in Gaza. I've only met him online, as it is pretty hard to meet someone from Gaza unless they have a permit or you have a permit. He wanted to come to an art festival in Jerusalem I was participating in, but he couldn't get a permit. He's a talented photographer and has recorded stories for us today. But first, here's Roni.
So I live in a village called Netiv HaAsara, which is in fact the closest village to the Gaza Strip. Mm-hmm. Our village was first established in 1972, not here, but in the northern Sinai. Then one of 11 villages, together with a town called Yamit, planned as a buffer zone between Egypt and the Gaza Strip. 10 years later, 10 beautiful years later, we had to move in accordance with the peace treaty with Egypt. What happened was in 1979, Anwar Sadat offered his hand in peace. It was something that we never thought would ever happen, which of course made us all very happy. We knew that the condition for this peace was that we have to move this beautiful life we managed to create there. Somehow it also created a sort of a conflict within each and every one of us, because on the one hand the longing for peace, and on the other hand our concept of peace didn't go together with having to be evacuated from our homes, having to uproot our plantations. It somehow didn't go together. But when we realized that was the only way, then it was obvious what we should do. And we chose a group of people to look over the country and decide where we should relocate ourselves. And this is the place they chose. And many people do ask, what on earth made you come to be on the border of the Gaza Strip? Mm-hmm. So we came here in 1982 and started building our new life. And we came here 66 families, 56 from the original village, and another 10 families, all from neighboring villages in the northern Sinai. So they were all people. We were all people who left our homes and were reimbursed and compensated compensated for everything we left behind. And with that, we built our new village. today, we're 230 families on the village, over 800 people, and we're in about a year and a half or so, another 71 families will be joining us. First years here were really beautiful. We were very busy in building our life. We had a very good relationship, a normal relationship, I say, with our neighbors across the border. Many of them came to work with us. We'd visit there, they'd visit here. A really normal relationship until the beginning of 1990s. Things started changing, and every now and then there was a suicidal bomb. No one was allowed in or out. And those were really the times that I felt most afraid of being so close, because knowing those people who were there without anything to do, without being able to go out to work and provide for their families, this was when I really thought only harm can come here, only damage, only more violence. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. Are you still with me?
Yep.
Okay. I have to make sure every now and then.
Yeah.
So as soon, and then we had the, they started with the rockets and the missiles and the mortar shells. And I can say that for the past nearly 15 years, we've been under constant threat of alerts and running into our shelters, or safe rooms, we call them today, and knowing that we have 15 seconds from the alert to get into shelter, which is a very, very short time. Mm-hmm. If you're at home, it's fairly safe enough, but if you go outside anywhere, to run to a shelter is really difficult in such a short time. We do have these safe rooms all along the way, near the kindergartens and in the greenhouse, and near the greenhouses in the fields and so on. But we know the rockets are fairly primitive. They can't really target, although over the years they are getting more and more sophisticated. But we do know that if they hit, then there's no way out. Mm-hmm. They can't target, but every now and then it does hit. And I'm not talking about war times, which is much worse, of course. Just on a regular basis. I mean, it can be like once in a month or once in a few weeks, but we still get an alert and we still have to run into shelter. And we hear the Palestinians training on the other side, because the whole time there's talk of the next round, both on this side and on the other side. And I find that instead of talking about how to stop the next round, we're just preparing for the next round. If it's with ammunition, if it's training, if it's building more shelters and more safe rooms, very important, because in case we don't succeed, but I feel that a much longer range solution can be achieved, not through violence. I think that's about general, how we live, and I know people do ask and say, you know, well, why are you there? If it's so bad and so stressful, why don't you leave? But I don't really think that's an option. This is my home. Why should I have to leave? Mm-hmm. I'm not doing any wrong by living here, so why should I leave? The thing is that, I'll say, different from other people who find it very difficult to see the other side, I've been exposed to another side of the story of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, which has made life very difficult for me, because it was very easy when I knew one side of the story. I always knew I was in the right, everything I do is quite legitimate, and all of a sudden I'm exposed to some doubts and some understanding that there are people on the other side. It's not just a situation. It's not just ammunition. There are people behind that, and we have to try and understand why they get to this to the situation they're in at the moment. Why should the only thing they want to do is use more weapons and more violence? I don't know if you wanted me to go into the story of how I was exposed to the other side.
Yeah, if you could do it sort of quickly, that would be great. Yeah. We have time. Like, don't worry too much. But as much as you're willing to tell and what you think is important, we're happy to hear.
Okay. So the privilege I had of seeing the other side was when my husband was sent to Egypt as an agricultural consultant, and I met people there who told me how they feel and how they see the problem in this region. And I met many people who refused to talk to me at first because I'm Israeli. And this made me want to understand more, want to understand who these people are. And I started reading a lot about the Palestinians. And when people in Israel would say to me, you know, who are these Palestinians? Where are they from? Why should we worry about what's happening to the Palestinians? They don't have a history like ours of 5,000 years. So I started reading up and trying to find out who they are and where they come from. And every book I took gave a different story. It was very difficult to find exactly. Some say that the Philistines from biblical times, when Moses arrived here in Israel, those were the ancient Palestinians. Some say there's no connection whatsoever. But every now and then, as I started reading along, I sort of thought, what does it really matter if they have a history of 5,000 years or 500 years? The thing is that today there is a Palestinian people. And they need a home. And no other Arab nation regards them as equal. And although I might think that an Arab is an Arab is an Arab, no matter where he's from, it's not like that at all. And then I said, well, hang on. I know what it's like to live in countries where I'm not accepted as completely equal. I know what it's like to need a homeland as a Jewish person. So I really should understand the Palestinians more than anyone else. Mm. And that's when I started trying to connect and talk and make other people try and understand, try to feel that the only way that there's a chance for a change is if we see the other people, see what they're up against, understand. And understanding, it doesn't always mean agree and accept. Within your family, you don't all the time agree, but you understand one another, and you try to see how where each one is coming from, and this is what we've got to do here, and somehow, the leaderships on either side aren't getting this at all. They don't realize that there's never going to be one instead of the other. We're all going to be here, whether we like it or not, but we're here, and we're here to stay, both the Palestinians and the Israelis. So we've got to make every possible effort to live side by side. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And you volunteered to drive people to hospital?
Yes. So some of the ways I managed to connect, it's very difficult to connect with Gaza because I can't go in. It's impossible for me to go and visit there. So I connect with people through telephone calls and through Skype. And every now and then I volunteer and go and pick up people who need to get to hospital, because that's a fairly easy way or acceptable way for people to get a permit. If someone's sick and needs treatment in hospital in Israel, they usually, almost always, get a permit to come across. And then I pick them up, and on the way, we can talk. We can try and understand one another.
How was your first time doing that job?
Pardon?
How was the first time doing that? Were you nervous at all, or did you have a good experience?
No, I never felt nervous, really, because I do know they go through a screening process, and not everyone is allowed across. And I know today when I work so much more with trying to get permits for people to come over, not only when they're sick, then I know that they do look into each case very, very carefully. So if they get a permit, I really don't think I have any reason to fear. So I've never felt any sort of tension in picking them up. And I do, and with some of the people, I never see again afterwards. But some of them, we connect in a deeper way. And I speak to them regularly over the phone. During the wars, we were up 10, 15 times a day, I'd be on the phone. And one of my friends in Gaza has been here on television, and they've recorded her interview, her talks with me, and have interviewed her as well. In fact, next week we're having a meeting of the organization I work with, which is called Other Voice, and we're going to have a meeting on trying to build a certain strategy. And we've invited, and I've managed to get permits for two people to come across from Gaza to give their input and to try and see whether or how we can strengthen them and give them, make them realize that we've got to hear them as well. It's not enough that I say they're people there. We need more Israeli people to hear them. That not only we want peace. I know for a fact that it's not only us, but more people need to hear it. And that's what we're going to try and, on Sunday, in fact, we're having this meeting, and we're going to try and see what we can do to make us work, to hear more positive sounds on the other side.
I wish you luck with that.
Thank you.
When I met you, I remember you described Maha as your soulmate. And
yes.
Can you talk about that a bit?
I think I've got many close friends there, but she is the closest. I definitely feel for her the whole time. She's coming across. She'll be at the meeting on Sunday. I traveled with her to the States. We both spoke at the J Street conference a year ago, and she had a very strong impact there. I'll be in Washington again in October, this October, to speak to an organization there in their conference they're having. So I try to go out, because I think that only through these other ways abroad, maybe what I say will also fall is that I can't speak to, because they're not available at the moment. And that's the main reason I travel a lot and speak to whoever wants to hear.
And a question I usually ask a lot of people is, what are you hoping for the coming years with Gaza? Like, what do you see as like a realistic step forward?
I do think that the most important step really is to open the borders more freely. I think that we have to let more people out. I think the fact that they're closed in like they are is perfect ground for the radicals to build up and influence more and more people there, that they are their only salvation. Only if they come out and see other things here will they know that it's not the case at all. That, I think, has got to be the first step. For more people in Gaza to hear and see people on this side, just as I need to see them. And try and persuade the leadership that the strategy of violence and preparing for the next round of violence isn't working. Because the consequence isn't going to be any better. we might end at a certain ceasefire again, but then we'll start talking of another round. It just doesn't work. I mean, we're evident of this over the last few years. That's what we're trying to do. Yes, the day before yesterday, there's another organization called Women Waging Peace. I don't actually belong to the organization. I'm not one of the people there, but I go to all their, any event they have and any protest or whatever. And they, for the past 50 days, have had this like a marathon of fasting. Some fast fasted for 24, 5 hours, some for 50 hours. And for 50 days, the 50 days of the last war, they were outside the Prime Minister's office and demonstrated there. And the 50 days were up the day before yesterday. Mm. And I went and joined them there. And the most uplifting and hopeful aspect of it was that there were so many people there, people crying out to the Prime Minister to change the strategy and get back down to the negotiating table, because violence is not getting us anywhere.
Hmm. Thank you. I think I have just one more question, which I hope, you know, won't take up too much energy, which is just that when you started your reading and learning about Palestinians and then working in Gaza, like, how long was your process of sort of switching your mind over and learning? Like, I'm sure it didn't happen very fast, and probably had to go through some quite intense, you know, self-reflection.
The thing is, I grew up, my parents came to live in Israel from England because they believed that this is the home for the Jewish people. And I grew up with a family, with a very Zionist family, and as far as I was concerned, we could do no wrong. Everything was right. And it was only when I went to Egypt and started hearing the other side and then hearing more and more and reading more and more, I realized that I'm not saying that we should get up and leave the country and give it back to the Palestinians. I'm not there. But I'm just saying that we've got to acknowledge the fact that the Palestinians have been here for a long, long time, for generations. And when Israel was established, the facts show it everywhere, that people were dislocated from their homes, were evacuated from their homes, for us to come and live here. Now, I can't forget that. And I don't think, you know, it's just like when you never acknowledge the fact that you made a mistake, you'll never correct it. And I know I say that to my children, to my grandchildren, on a much simpler basis. But here as well, I think that if we don't accept that certain wrongs were done, then we're not going to move forward. And I can't give you a really time limit when I started feeling awkward and bad about it, but it took years. But again, I must say, I know that this is my home, and I don't want anyone to think that when I criticize it because I don't love my country. I do, and that's why I'm still here. It's just like when I told my children off when they misbehaved, it wasn't because I didn't love them. I love them very much, and that's why I wanted to make their whatever they were doing right. And the same goes for the country as well. And that's when people say to me, how can you talk like this as an Israeli? You know, we don't want to know. We love your country. And I said, but I love my country too. And I'm not giving it up. I'm just saying that we've got to acknowledge the fact that there are other people who are entitled to live here. And we've got to accept them as equal. And we've got to accept the fact that there was mistrust that was done. Now, I know when I ask other friends, when I read these books, and I sometimes ask friends of mine, and I say, read this book, read, see what you think. And they say, no, I don't want to, because they don't want to have that doubt.
Well, Thank you so much for talking with me.
It's quite all right, Nicole.
Yeah.
And all the best.
Thanks. Do you want to, can you just say your full name for me so I can put it in there?
Ronnie Kedar.
Okay. Thank you so much and have a productive weekend.
Thank you very much. You too.
Bye.
Bye.
This next few minutes is a story from Ahmed Gamel, who lives in Gaza. He's writing last year about the war and about conditions in Gaza. The text is online on the Partners for Progressive Israel blog to help you read along, as he does have a thick accent, which he does apologize for, but that is A-okay. Here we go.
In Gaza, enough is enough. Those who travel and those who tear all time, and the bitter who could come over all his problems. But the troubles are still, so what should we say? In Gaza, there are many horrible and terrible stories which are kept in minds forever. Life in Gaza means a big casket, which its nails run away from wood to stick to bodies. The Gazan people omit the word pain from their dictionary of life, since they live in the center of war field. People who survived from the previous war are waiting their rule in the next war. Just take this simple for people suffering. When a patient and his wife entered Al Nasser hospital for eyes to check and have a surgical operation on one of his eyes, all the matter was wonderful. But when the doctor did everything for him using batteries to see well, as there is no thing called electricity in Gaza. Another case is water, which is sold for people as pure and healthy. But water stations sometimes deceive people by adding chlorine for ordinary one to get more money, which may cause some diseases in some cases. The cement is another horrible story, which is sold in the black market by traders who look for wealth. Each ton of cement costs 5 and 50 hundred shekels, the real price, but traders sell it to people in 1,500 shekels. So traders just want money by any way, whether their people suffer or not. Gaza lies under hard siege since 2007, and all borders are blocked. Only traders can go and come through these borders, as they are investors to collect a lot of money from the poor blood. Troubles never ends in Gaza. Be reply, Gaza is under a hard Israeli siege, and the wars which left behind them thousands of victims have no fault just because they live in this small part, Gaza.
Thank you for listening. I hope that was inspiring to hear from someone who's in Gaza calling for enough is enough and hearing from an Israeli who loves Israel but also thinks enough is enough. It seems there are many ways for future prospects of peace. It just needs to be reached, and I think it can happen. People are willing to respect each other. Bye for now.